listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
I'm Rob Daly. This is your weekly podcast looking at all the major stories from Spain, Germany, Italy, France and more. My co-host is Chris Parrott.
Yep, huge David Moyes news. Real Madrid lose. There's big derbies everywhere, but the ultras stayed away at Roma-Lazio. We'll tell you why. And we discuss who's the best player under the age of 21 in Europe.
This week we're joined by Spanish football journalist Guillaume Balague to discuss his new book on Cristiano Ronaldo. Archie Rintat is here. He was at Borussia Dortmund against Schalke, the BT Sport European football expert. And commentator Will Downing tells us about one of the biggest games of the season in Belgium.
This is Football in Europe.
Thanks for downloading the podcast. We got into the iTunes podcast chart for the first time last week, and we're really happy about that. So leave us a review, and it helps us stay up there with the big boys if you do have a minute or so. Chris, Guillaume Balague this week.
Yeah.
Very exciting indeed. He's going to be on to discuss his new book about Cristiano Ronaldo. We're going to hear from him shortly. But first, have you seen the trailer for the new Ronaldo movie?
I have. Only Cristiano Ronaldo could do such a thing.
Yeah, because it's like an authorised film. And he's been doing the rounds, doing interviews to publicise the film.
Yeah, I mean, the film looks almost as you'd expect. Just, if you're a fan, great insight into his life. Obviously, it's coming from Ronaldo's perspective, but almost the best thing is, because he's had to publicise it, he's done loads of interviews. I'm the best player in the world. In fairness to him, he doesn't fudge the questions. He's not one of these, I'm not really going to give much away.
But it's a different type of PR, isn't it? It's like a...
But do you know what I mean?
He's not scared of being... brash about his own abilities.
Exactly.
Now.
Monotone, don't want to upset anybody, so I'll just give a soundbite that, you know, anyone could give type thing, which you hear from a lot of managers now, I think. But Ronaldo's not like that. Yeah, I'm better than Messi, is what he said. Quite refreshing, actually.
Get in touch with us using FIE Podcast on Twitter. Dylan Glass, Chris, wants to know, because he is enjoying the show, but he wants to hear some MLS chat, because it's not European football, obviously, but the likes of Didier Drogba, Giovinco, Robbie Keane, all out there.
We'll do it at the end of the season when the playoffs are over. Not long, actually. We know Phil Blacker, who does the commentary for Sky Sports and a lot of the MLS games, so we're going to get him on.
Have you spoke to him about that, though?
Yeah, he said fine.
Have you actually asked him, or are we asking him now on this?
He said that he was happy to come on.
In the pub?
It was last week. And he is also the man who does the voiceovers.
He is on our show, yeah. So we'll have Phil on to talk MLS. I mentioned Sligo Rovers the other week, Chris, because I went to see them against St. Pat's. And Mickey Adams was there as manager, you may remember from a previous podcast. Well, Jamie O'Halloran has tweeted me to say, Mickey Adams has gone. So thank you very much for flagging that up, Jamie. I saw one of his last games in charge of Sligo. A historic. Mickey. I was at Sir Alex Ferguson's last ever home game, but Mickey Adams at St. Pat's, keeping Sligo in the top flight, is right up there as well. Keep your tweets coming in, and a big thanks to the likes of Tom Roberts, Ryan Miller and Van der Drake, who've left us nice comments and tweets as well. Let's start this week with La Liga. We'll hear from Guillaume Balague shortly.
This is Football in Europe, La Liga latest.
Real Madrid were beaten for the first time this season under Rafa Benitez by Sevilla. We'll get onto that in a moment. But Chris, David Moyes, at the time of recording, everyone's saying he's going to be sacked as Real Sociedad manager after losing to a very lowly side in Las Palmas on Friday night.
Yep, the final straw for David Moyes, who took over about a year ago in San Sebastian. 9 points from 11 games. He leaves them above the relegation zone on goal difference. We heard from Graham Hunter last week. He thinks that he's not been given the tools to do the job, and the reason that he was brought in to scout and buy players, he hasn't been able to do.
Like he did at Everton.
Tried to change the style to a more British way of playing. We'll get Guillaume's thoughts on that in a moment, which are very interesting. But you never quite know until it's absolutely official. But David Moyes,
it looks done, doesn't it?
Looks done, and will be fascinating to see where he goes now. Many Premier League sides, I'm sure, will look at David Moyes and still fancy him.
Chris, Celta Vigo, one of this season's star teams. They've been up around the top of the table, Champions League spots, but beaten by Valencia 5-1 at home.
Yeah.
What happened there?
They were hammered. Two for Paco Alcácer, two for Dani Parejo. Had been 1-1. It's a Celta side who love to attack. They're playing with a freedom, really. And maybe sometimes when you do that, you do get a beating every now and then. I don't think it will change the way they're playing. But great result for Valencia, who are up to seventh now and a point off Eibar in the final European place. Brilliant result for them. But yeah, probably one of the surprise scorelines certainly in Spain, if not the whole of Europe.
And considering the fact that Nuno, the head coach at Valencia, has been getting lots of stick from their fans, we want you to go. They want them to play Negredo, and he won't play Negredo. Well, they won without him, 5-1 at the weekend. Great result for Valencia, and much needed as well. Barcelona, Villarreal. Again, Villarreal, like Celta Vigo, Chris, around the Champions League spots. And two teams who play great football, but Barcelona beating them without Messi still in fairly easy fashion.
Yeah, 3-0. Very, very impressive. And Neymar scored a magnificent goal. He flicked it over the defender.
This is one of the best goals I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, he's exceptional at the moment. Flicked it over the defender's head, volleyed it in. 3-0 win. Him and Suarez getting the goals again. And this, well, they've scored Barcelona's last 16 Liga goals.
We've had a tweet in from Rumbles on Twitter. He says he loves the podcast and would love our thoughts on Deportivo being doing so well this season. Deportivo have had a bit of a rough run actually of late. They haven't won, I think, in 5 or 6. But we'll get on to Deportivo on the next show, yeah, Chris, when we talk about La Liga, because there's so much to get through. Real Madrid lost 3-2 Sevilla on Sunday night. A first defeat under Rafa Benitez. Fair play to him. Got to November without losing a game.
Well, it was a brilliant game. They took the lead. Sergio Ramos against his boyhood side of an amazing bicycle kick. He then was forced off. They brought in Rafael Varane to go into the middle of defence alongside Pepe. They also had Kiko Casillas in goal and not Keylor Navas, who's been so brilliant. And they fell apart defensively, in all honesty. Chiro Immobile, Banega and Llorente scored to put Sevilla 3-1 up. Then a late, lovely goal from James Rodriguez, assisted by Gareth Bale, who was making his return. But Real Madrid's reasonably well beaten. And as you mentioned, Rafa Benitez loses that unbeaten record and they fall 3 points behind Barcelona ahead of El Clasico after the international break.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Joining us now on Football in Europe is the Spanish football journalist Guillaume Balaguer. You'll know him from his work on Sky Sports and with various publications in the UK and Spain as well. Guillaume, thanks for joining us. Your new book on Cristiano Ronaldo is out. And I have started reading it over the weekend. It seems important to you that people know this isn't an authorised, Ronaldo-endorsed biography. Why is that the case?
Let's say that there was a plan for us working together. And I spoke to Cristiano four occasions. He was happy that that was the case. Just got to a point where I realised that having done an authorised book on Messi, where once everything was written, once the manuscript was done, not a comma was changed. And having done a book with Pep Guardiola, where he opened up the doors to the changing room and to his life, really. And when I asked him for him to read at least one episode, one chapter that was more or less about his psychology and the way he thought, he said to me, no, you write it. I trust you. Go to, when it's published, I'll go to the shop and buy the book. That was not what, not so much Ronaldo, but the people working with him wanted of me. So it got to a point where we couldn't just basically work together. So that was all made easy by the reaction to something I wrote in the Messi book. By that time, anyway, I had done most of the interviews and the research, but it got to that point where it was like, I am in a position, I feel, where I can write my own book and then people can take their own conclusions of what Ronaldo does, like in the movie, for instance, is what Ronaldo likes to do. What I like to do, it's just my vision of him based on hours of research and work behind the scenes to find out who he is.
Guillaume, it's Chris here. There's been so many Ronaldo books written and he comes across anyway as this clinical character. Do you think you found out who the real Ronaldo is?
I don't think anybody can find out who the real person is. Even if I did an biography of myself, I wouldn't be writing it. What I found out is you start with an idea of the man. I've presented commercial events with him. I've been in private situations with him. But then when you start scratching, you kind of feel, I don't know if the right word is sorry, but certainly you feel much closer or understanding. You have a closer understanding of why he reacts the way he reacts. And a lot of it has to do with, obviously, his background and his developing as a child, parents absent, with hardly no education, with maturity that reached him far too early, which sometimes is not really maturity. What it is a lack of social skills, of the ability to understand what is required at any moment. What you get is the facility to reach your dreams because you don't have monitoring parents, you don't have the obsession of parents to go to university or anything like that, where you have the freedom to do what you want. But what you also have is a constant search for identity because the identity was not formed as a kid. That means identity is very closely linked to results, do really well on the pitch, and he's got a huge necessity to be loved.
Is this why it's so important for him to be recognised as not just part of a team, but for his accomplishments to be recognised as an individual.
Basically, yes, could have been a tennis player, whatever he wanted, decided to go on football, not because of the pleasure that gives him to be part of a collective, perhaps, but in search of recognition, number one. Number two, because you become a player, a football player, if people around you feel that that's the way to impress them. It was the same with Messi, the same with so many footballers. The parents, the relatives look at you when you're a 3-4-year-old and you do something nice with the ball, look at you with big eyes. And what Messi and Ronaldo have tried to do since then is to replicate those eyes and that look of admiration. He had a mother who loved football. He had a godfather who loved football. Dad was involved in football. He was always going to be a footballer. And once in there, it was all about life and death, win or defeat. And when he lost, there were a lot of crying. And that crying is just because he felt every defeat was like a little death. When that happens, of course, that is a source of motivation. It's a little tragedy, I think, as well, because all you do is trying to win. And that has been what he's trying to do since then. The question mark is, now that he's picked physically, what happens after? How does he deal with the absence of that admiration of 70, 80,000 people looking at him? Still a few years before that happens. But, you know, what happens after that is also a fascinating question that I try to answer in the book.
Guillaume, something I'm fascinated by is the relationship between Ronaldo and Jorge Mendes. What are your thoughts on how the pair, his agent, of course, worked together?
It's a little bit like Sir Ferguson and Ronaldo, in the sense that, do you think Sir Alex would have spent so much time and love and dedication to somebody only because he felt he was a young kid in need of a father, which it is true? Or is it because of the talent that could actually make a difference to his team? And I do think it's a bit of both. In the case of Jorge Mendes, it's probably a bit of both as well. Jorge Mendes is another Cristiano Ronaldo. He's a guy that needs to constantly get better and get the bigger deal and be the best agent. He looks after him better than he looks after anybody else. Well, does he look after him because he feels that he's a little bit of a lost son or somebody that like a younger brother? Or is it because he's the most lucrative client that he has? And it probably is a mixture of both. What's quite clear is that a lot of other clients of Jorge Mendes feel jealousy of that relationship because very disproportionate compared to the time that Mendes dedicated to others. It's only logical, I presume, if you are in that business. There is a loving relationship there and a commercial relationship there for sure.
We can't let you go without discussing David Moyes. His time at Real Sociedad has come to an end. Why is that the case, basically, and how do you think he'll be perceived in Spain?
David Moyes will be sacked because Real Sociedad feel that he wasn't doing the job that they expected. There's been warnings along the way. What I would take out of that is for British coaches to have a look at it very closely and to realise why it has happened, why he couldn't succeed, what was missing, not only in the personal decisions of David Moyes, but also generally in the culture that made him a coach. Why is he insufficient when he goes to Real Sociedad? Why does he do well at Everton and even get signed by Manchester United, let's not forget? But then goes to Real Sociedad, it doesn't work. And I think that tells you a lot about the culture of British coaching. And I think there's a lot of lessons that can be learned from there. Don't blame just the club. Don't blame just David Moyes. Is there anything else that has made this happen?
Again, I look forward to finishing the book. It is out now, Guillaume Balaguer's biography on Cristiano Ronaldo. Guillaume, thanks for joining us on the show.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Football in Europe.
Chris, it's that time of year that we all wait for. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The European Golden Boy Awards.
Actually, quite a good award. Terribly named.
I hate the name so much.
Some marketing
know why.
Firm would have been paid a lot of money.
This is where the 40 best players under the age of 21 nominated for an award who will be the Golden Boy. Raheem Sterling has won this award before. Paul Pogba, I think Wayne Rooney, Mario Götze have won it. So they've got quite a good record, yeah. Chris. Who's on the list this year?
Well, it's a big list. It's 40 names. So, I mean, that's almost all of the people that are playing regularly under 21. But from the Premier League, there's the likes of Hector Bellerin, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Jordan Ibe, Anthony Martial. Then you've got Kingsley Coman from the Bundesliga, Anwar El Ghazi from Ajax, Ricardo Kishner, who's at Lazio. That type of individual. We joke about the name, but this is the creme de la creme of the young players.
Also, Chris, on the list is Gens Moses Simon, who hasn't been playing much this year. He's had injury, and he hasn't been playing that great when he has played. But he's on the list regardless because he helped Ghent win the league title. And Jamie Lawrence, who we had, you remember, the first ever show, we had Jamie Lawrence on, the FC Trenčín English defender who's playing his football in Slovakia. He played with Moses Simon there. So when Simon was linked with Spurs, I asked him, you know, how good a player is he?
He's a great footballer. He's small, but he is so quick, and he does unexpected things. And he's, yeah, he's impossible to defend against because you don't know what he's going to do next. And he's got those quick feet, always in the right place. He scores a goal, and as a winger, you know, what do you want? He'd have to work on his strength a bit. He'd have to work on, you know, his physicality. Obviously, the Premier League is a step up in terms of that. But yeah, I think he absolutely could. You know, he's a really nice guy as well. I think he'd do well.
All right, Chris, out of that shortlist, and people can find this online easily, who do you think who should win the award?
It's not particularly original, but Anthony Martial is on it.
No, I still think that's quite a bold choice. I know he's the most expensive teenager of all time, but
I've seen him three or four times live for United this season, and he is exceptional. I've never seen a player who beats, if he plays on the wing, who beats the fullback time and time again. He just glides past people, and then he goes up front against big, burly centre forwards, and he's strong enough to take those challenges to hold up play. And we've already seen what a good finisher he is. He's, for that young, he's a frightening prospect.
I'll go with Kingsley Coman, the Bayern winger who's doing very well in the first team and has stepped up dramatically. Let us know what you think. Who should be the European Golden Boy? FIE Podcast on Twitter.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga Roundup.
Well, that is the sound of the Westfalenstadion, the home of Borussia Dortmund. And I was there early in the season to record that wonderful rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone. I'm sure it sounded even better at the weekend as Dortmund took on their fierce rivals Schalke. BT Sports' Archie Rintat joins us now on the show as he was there. Archie, thanks for coming on.
Hi there, Rob, and hi there, Chris. Pleasure to be joining you.
Archie, tell us the story. How did you get into this game? Because many consider it to be the best game you can get to in Germany.
It is the mother of all derbies, as they say around the area. And yes, it's not the easiest game of football to get into either. I had a rather stupid plan that I would get in just to watch it with the fans, because to say that fans of Borussia Dortmund and Schalke in an area which is called the Ruhrgebiet, it's very working class, to say that football is everything for them would be a real understatement. So I know to really feel some of that passion kind of close up, I'd already been fortunate to experience it once. That was a real kind of aim of mine. And through some rather unorthodox tactics, I did manage to acquire entry to the game.
Can you go into it?
I can if you wish. I have a friend of a friend who told me to go and watch the game or go and talk to a man called Tim in Dortmund. Now, Tim is very much Dortmund born and bred, as he put it to me. He grew up standing on the Südtribüne, the famous yellow wall where 25,000 Borussia Dortmund fans stand for each home game. He, along with his wife, who for some reason he seemed to prioritize me getting a ticket over his wife, who didn't have a ticket. I wouldn't risk that with someone who I was in a relationship with. I would fully be getting them a ticket first of all before looking into any kind of new person that I'd met. But he managed to find someone outside the Südtribüne who was selling them for just around 60 euros, I think it was. I've got the ticket in front of me, 57.50 euros, but there was obviously just a tiny bit of markup. But that also just worth saying, given the fact that I think that the view of German football in England is that, okay, it's the land of milk and honey when it comes to tickets. It just costs absolutely nothing to get into a game. They do mark up in the same way that the English clubs do, although that said, that amount that I've just told you there equates to around 40 quid. You would expect to pay a lot more for the best derby in England.
And you did get an amazing game for that money as well, Archie. 3-2 to Dortmund. How good was it and what was the story of this one?
I found it quite cagey in the first half an hour, but I didn't think that was necessarily because either side was playing badly. Schalke set up a little bit more defensively than they have. That was probably paying respects to the way that Dortmund have attacked this season. They are averaging over 3 goals per game. But I think it said a lot about the way that Borussia Dortmund have changed under Thomas Tuchel that they were able to grind out the win here. They were so clinical going forward, and that has not been a quality that we've seen in recent seasons when they played under Jurgen Klopp. It's been much more, they create loads of chances but only take a few. And the impression I got from Tim was that this is just the sort of game where that in the past they would have probably not taken their chances and Schalke would have squeaked out with a win. You look at the way that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, for example, is playing at the moment, the derby hero. A lot's being made of the fact that he raised his T-shirt with Batman on it again, following up his celebration against Schalke last season. He's now scored in every single home game for Borussia Dortmund that he's played in this season. And the fact that he's been so deadly, really stepping up after an okay season last year, but it's really given Dortmund something. Okay, he's not quite the same standard as Robert Lewandowski, not in my opinion anyway. He is so vital to the way that Borussia Dortmund are playing right now. These fans, these players, they really do feel everything emotionally. You can see that in terms of the celebrations that there were at the end yesterday. To have the results that they've had under Thomas Tuchel has been a great relief to them almost to kind of get back to these standards so quickly after the horror show that last season was. Okay, they ended up finishing in seventh place, but still that's not where the club has aspired to be in recent times. Julian Weigl in particular was speaking last week and talking about how he feels that he's getting better in every single training session under Thomas Tuchel. And he's being described as someone who is Fußball verrückt, which means he's football crazy in terms of the way that he analyzes the game. And I associate that, I think, in the same way with kind of Pep Guardiola, these people who are incessant when it comes to the detail. And I think that Dortmund are going to profit from that long term as well.
Yeah, Dortmund only 5 points behind from Bayern at the moment. Chris, you did commentate for Bundesliga Radio on Bayern beating Stuttgart 4-0. What was the story of that game?
Well, it was 4. It could have been 10, to be honest. They were 4 up at half time. Robin, Douglas Costa got goals relatively early on. A couple of chances for Stuttgart at 2-0. They missed them, hit the bar. And then Lewandowski and Müller scored. They were just so much better than Stuttgart. It was frightening. Perfect day as well because Holger Badstuber returned out since April. And really, the second half was a non-event, apart from him coming on. And the Allianz basically sung his name for the whole of the second half.
And it looks like that Pep Guardiola will sit down and talk with Bayern about his future in December. That's the way they're talking about it. Now, Archie, I'll just go through a couple of the results from the weekend. André Schubert, for the first time, as Borussia Mönchengladbach interim head coach, dropped points in the Bundesliga with a 0-0 draw against Ingolstadt. Mainz beat Wolfsburg 2-0. Yunus Mali on the score sheet. He recently opted to play for Turkey because Germany were looking at him. And Archie, a final one on your local boys. I've been to watch Köln, FC Cologne, with you, and they beat Leverkusen 2-1. How did they get that? And what a great result.
Yes, a 13-mile trip up the road. Across the River Rhine they went, and they came back with the result that they very much yearned for. This is not the biggest derby for FC. The big derby for them is Borussia Mönchengladbach. However, they still very, very much want to beat Leverkusen. Dominic Marrow, a guy who has not been a regular this season at centre-back. Last season, he very much formed a fantastic centre-back partnership with Kevin Vimmer, now of Tottenham. But this season, he's found it much more difficult to break back into the side after an injury in pre-season. But he scored twice at the weekend. He came in for Fredrik Sorensen at the back. And I think it's going to be very difficult for Sorensen to work his way back into the side because Marrow has very much solidified his reputation as a derby hero. And especially with Carnival coming round here on Wednesday, which is just a huge celebration. It's the start of it anyway. And I think that the mood in the city at the moment is euphoric. It tends to be whenever Cologne win, but real problems for Leverkusen, on the other hand. Defensively, they look very shoddy, as we've seen in those games against Roma twice. Okay, they did come back in both, but taking only a point out of those two could prove pretty costly to them in terms of their Champions League qualification.
Archie, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, mate.
Not a problem, Rob. Cheers.
This is Football in Europe, Liga Roundup.
Chris, Liga and football now. Let's look at this. A big derby, another big derby. Lyon against Saint-Etienne. Why is this one such a special fixture?
Well, like so many derbies, it's not just about football. It's about class. It's about two towns, big cities, only 50 kilometres apart. Lyon considered to be the more affluent, Saint-Etienne, the more working class, industrial. Two teams with massive history. Saint-Etienne dominated French football in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Yep. Reached the European Cup final. Lyon, with a bit of money behind them, then dominated in the early millennium, which didn't go down particularly well in Saint-Etienne. So there's a lot of animosity. It's a great derby, and it was a great win for Lyon. They won 3-0 at home, and Alexander Lacazette, beginning to come back into form, got a hat-trick.
Well, a big relief for him because he hasn't been scoring many goals this season, and a big result for Lyon because I mean, they were. I thought they were rubbish. They have been not very good in the Champions League. They lost to Zenit and they're heading out.
Yeah, they are. And they were very poor in that game. It was a huge match for them. But there's been a lot of talk that this isn't the same Lyon team as last year. They've lost Fekir for the season. But
injured, yeah.
They are the best of the rest behind Paris Saint-Germain still at the moment. And if they aren't as good and they haven't quite hit their full potential, then to be second, albeit 10 points behind Paris Saint-Germain, is still not a bad start. And minimum requirement is to get back in the top three, back in the Champions League. And they're doing that at the moment.
Yeah, despite the fact that things haven't been going on brilliantly behind the scenes on the training ground at Lyon. Meanwhile, Karim Benzema has been charged with conspiracy to blackmail as part of an investigation into an alleged rather private tape involving Mathieu Valbuena. You've probably seen this, a news story in the week if you're into European football. We did speak about this before on the podcast, as Gibril Cissé was questioned by police as part of this investigation. Just a mad story, but Benzema still has the full support of Real Madrid. He'll continue to play for them. But in the meantime, Valbuena and Benzema can't be together. And that includes playing for the French national team, which has opened up some gaps in that squad, Chris.
Yeah, they play England in a friendly, don't they? And three notable inclusions in their squad. It's a massive 6 months coming up. The chance to play in a home European Championship isn't one that comes around very often. And Gignac, who's playing in Mexico now, has been called up. He's been in great goal-scoring form there. Hatem Ben Arfa has been brilliant for Nice, is in the squad.
Yeah, you called that as well, that he might be getting in the squad.
Huge for Ben Arfa and Kingsley Coman, who I think has played more football at Bayern than I expected after moving from Juventus. Pep Guardiola clearly trusts him. He's played in the Champions League, he plays in the Bundesliga. Particularly Ben Arfa and Gignac, I think at the start of the season, wouldn't have thought that I can go to Euro. They do now.
Paris Saint-Germain, after a defeat to Real Madrid, they were unlucky in that game. A beat to lose by 5-0. A big win. Ibrahimovic with the couple in that one. And what's the mood in the Paris Saint-Germain camp, Chris?
Well, it's interesting because they were beaten by Real Madrid. I don't think they deserved to lose. I think they were unfortunate. They're dominating the league. Two interesting quotes after that game. Lucas Moura saying he thinks they can finish the league unbeaten, which we're only in November. Big call, but I wouldn't go against him necessarily the way they have started.
I mean, I don't like this kind of talk anyway. I just think it's
very premature.
But they might. I mean, they might actually.
Yeah, what an achievement that would be. And Thiago Silva saying, if we continue like this, after Christmas we'll be able to rest some players and concentrate on the Champions League. They expect to win Ligue 1. It's about how they're doing the Champions League. And next time they come up against someone of that quality will be in the knockout rounds, and there's no second chances then.
Paris Saint-Germain 10 points clear. Lyon in second after that win against Saint-Etienne. Caught up to third, but Marseille losing again at home to Nice. We'll look at that on a future show. Chris, French Cup.
French Cup, yeah.
Tell us about this.
One of my favourite competitions.
Okay.
In this, well, actually, there's shocks. You get some really small clubs that have won it recently. I remember Calais made the final, which was balmy. But at this stage, teams from the colonies come in. So
from the French colonies?
Yeah, like Martinique, Reunion, things like that. And a team from Brittany, Pontivy, have drawn a side from Tahiti, away from home.
Tahiti?
Yep, halfway between Peru and Australia. Put it into Google, it looks like the most idyllic islands.
What an away day that is.
I mean, if you're one of those players, don't mind the 22-hour flight.
If you're one of the fans, you're one of the real hardcore if you're off to that.
But it looks, I mean, you don't care if you win or lose. You're going to Tahiti.
So that's your latest on French football.
This is Football in Europe, Serie A Roundup.
Italy now. The Rome derby was the standout fixture of the weekend. Roma beating Lazio 2-0, even without the suspended Miralem Pjanic in the team. Mohamed Salah picked up an ankle injury, which could keep him out. I didn't see this match, Chris, only the highlights. So how did this one go?
They took the lead through Edin Dzeko. It was a controversial penalty. Foul looked to be outside the box. Gervinho got the second to make the point safe. But it was a bizarre game. One of the great atmospheres, of course, at the Stadio Olimpico. But the ultras, who, of course, they share the ground, so in the north and the south tribunes, if you like, they boycotted the game. They've been doing this recently due to new security measures that the local authorities want to put in. Of course, in Italy, they have quite a lot of power, the ultras, and they just didn't turn up. So they watched the game in the city. They saw off their heroes to the ground and then stayed away. The official attendance was something like 35,000, which in a ground that holds almost double that. Totti said afterwards, we need to get this resolved soon.
Because it's not the same.
It's not the same. And, you know, it's a wider issue, isn't it, football without fans? We've seen that a lot with the ticket protests across Europe.
We've been asking you to tweet us who you think is going to win the Serie A title, because me and Chris talked about it last week using FIE podcast. We'll just go through some of the scores first from the weekend. Juve beat Empoli 3-1 coming from behind. Massimo Macaroni scored, Middlesbrough fans. Mandžukić, Evra and Dybala got Juve the win, though. Fiorentina won again, 2-0 at Sampdoria. Condobia got the winner, Inter 1-0 victory at Torino. How many 1-0s is that, Chris?
They love it. Three in a row in Serie A, seven this season.
Oh, my God. 16-year-old Gianluigi Donnarumma kept another clean sheet as Milan were held to a 0-0 draw with Atalanta.
Four games now for the 16-year-old. Two clean sheets and, how about this, 12 catches and 11 saves, and he's 16.
Yeah, he's doing rather well in the AC Milan goal. And Napoli beat Udinese 1-0 with a Gonzalo Higuain goal. So you said Napoli are going to win the league, Chris. I said Roma. Here's a couple of tweets. Mohamed says he's going for Juve. He says they're still the best team in Serie A, and they still have that title-winning mentality. Rich Allen goes with Roma just for giving Lucas Digne a new lease of life, the defenders on loan from Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah, Brendy Ball says Juve have the biggest room for improvement and can spend in January, which is a fair point, actually. Inter don't have European football, which could help them.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
And David Cellini says Inter 2. No one's saying Napoli. Can't believe it.
No.
He says they're winning every week and never concede, which is true. We mentioned those 1-0 stats. Says the team also have lots of Balkan brilliance in it.
Yeah, it's fair enough. So that's your thoughts. Keep your tweets coming to us at FIE Podcast on the Serie A title race. A story of note, Chris. Carpi have brought back a manager just a month after they fired him. Fabrizio Castori led them to a historic promotion to Serie A and then was sacked a few games in. Then they brought in Giuseppe Sannino, one of Watford's former managers. They've binned him off now and brought back Castori just a few weeks after he was fired. I'm sure that's pretty satisfying for him. Ah, you need me back, eh? Chris, let's check in with Ravel Morrison.
Yeah.
He's at Lazio these days.
He is at Lazio. He made his first start in the Europa League, commentated on that game last Thursday against Rosenborg.
But he didn't play against Roma, did he?
He didn't play. He was in the matchday squad, and actually
he might break in.
More of an impact there than I thought he might be. We know his talent. I think you speak Gary Neville's on record as saying he was the most prodigious
United
talent
.
Coming through. It never worked. There's been plenty of things off the pitch, but one of them, we're not sure if he got the tattoo or if he just quoted it. Mike Tosin quote says, "I'm the best ever. I'm the most brutal and vicious and most ruthless champion there has ever been."
He did get this tattooed, or he's posted a picture of someone with it tattooed.
He posted a picture of, and people took it as, oh, he's got that tattoo. But then I read a little more and not totally sure, but just concentrate on football, Ravel,
just
come on, you're very, very good. And, you know, hopefully you're going to play more for Lazio, but less of the Tyson.
Let's go through the table then. Fiorentina top with Inter both on 27 points. Roma 26, Napoli 25. Just looking good in Italy this season.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.
Okay, almost at the end of the podcast, Chris, time for any other business. Normally, on any other week, Ajax against Feyenoord would probably be the big game we'd be talking about on the podcast.
Yeah.
So what happened in the game called Der Klassiker?
Yeah, it finished 1-1. David Klaassen got a big equaliser for Ajax. Otherwise, Giovanni van Bronckhorst's side would have had a massive win in the Dutch title race. Ajax remained top by 2 points. You can see how big a equaliser that was.
In Belgium this weekend, another huge match. Standard Liège against Anderlecht. On Sunday, I caught up with the TV commentator for that game, Will Downing, and asked him, in the era when all these derbies have a name, Der Klassiker, Classico, what is Standard Liège against Anderlecht known as?
Well, this is Der Klassiker. I think it's a pretty much modern name between Standard Liège and Anderlecht. 16 teams in the top flight. It is week 15 and maybe deliberately kept back for this week, the first meeting of Standard Liège and Anderlecht in the season. And because of the way the playoffs work, it's probably the first meeting of four. But for that to happen this season, Standard have to seriously climb up the table, going into this match 14th place out of the 16.
I mean, it's been a
astonishing season for Standard Liège to be so low in the table, but they got the win over Anderlecht 1-0.
It's quite interesting. It was Jonathan Legere, an Anderlecht old boy who'd been away for a couple of years, back in Belgian football, his first game against Anderlecht since he left them 3-4 years ago, and he scored after 3 minutes. It was a lovely little through ball by Anthony Knockout, formerly of Leicester City, who never really got a run out at the King Power Stadium, played it towards Legere on the edge of the 6-yard box, and he slotted past Silvio Proto. And from there, it might sound as if Standard defended the entire time. They had a couple of good chances after that, and then a brilliant free kick from Knockout early in the second half. Anderlecht huffed and puffed, tried very hard. A lot of their big names didn't really respond on the day. And in the bear pit that Standard Liège's home ground, the Sclessine can be, especially in this fixture, Standard held out 1-0. So they go up at the moment to 11th place. They had been bottom, which for a club of that size is quite extraordinary. But it looks as if, under their new youthful coach, Yannick Ferreira, their sixth coach in the space of 12 months, that the revival is on.
And in Stephen Defour, a player that Anderlecht have in midfield, he used to play for Standard Liège, and generally since that move, he gets a rough ride from his former club.
Well, definitely. I mean, his first return last year, a banner was unveiled by the Standard Liège ultras, which basically depicted a decapitated Defour. Now, the thing is, with big banners...
You said that very like it was a normal thing.
It definitely isn't. All big banners have to be vetted by the league and by the individual clubs before each game. So the Standard Liège fans, the ultras, had submitted a particular design and then smuggled a different one in for this particular game. Now, the same situation had happened this time around. They'd designed a banner that was going to be unveiled, and the ultras instead were allowed in too late for them to unfurl the banner this time around. It had been given the thumbs up and so on, but a little bit of colour therefore was lost ahead of this game. But I mean, we still had a huge amount of flares when the sides were coming out, and Stephen Defour and also Imu Ezekiel, who played for Standard Liège for a few years, went back to Qatar, came back on loan to Standard last season, scored against Anderlecht at the end of last season, and was sent off against them. Now wearing Anderlecht colours, both barracked heavily during the game, Defour particularly. It's still quite an unusual move, even though Jonathan Legere scored the winning goal and is an Anderlecht old boy himself.
Big thanks to Will for coming on the show. Also in Belgium this week, Chris, absolutely crazy scenes at the game between Lokeren and St. Truiden. There was a late equaliser from the goalkeeper, a header from William Dutoit, who smashed into the opposition goalkeeper. Mark Rodden, who's been on the show before, the football journalist, was messaging me about this. He says, the goalkeeper has been great since they got promoted. He scored a goal, then fainted, and he faints on the touchline, and then he made a save to preserve a point in the 97th minute. Presumably, he had become conscious once again after that. But a crazy season in Belgium as well, and Mark Rodden's good to follow on Twitter for the latest there. Chris, we talked about some madness at Trabzonspor, the referee being locked in the change room by the president after his team didn't get a penalty. Break down what's the latest with that.
Yeah, so you might remember he ordered the referee to be locked in and his assistants overnight was what he wanted because they didn't give a penalty.
I love that so much.
It's really good. I mean, as I said last week, Turkish Football Federation obviously had to do something. They have banned the president, Ertem Hasiosmanoglu. I went through that about five times off here. Banned for carrying out official functions for 280 days, best part of a year. Fined 150,000 Turkish lira.
How much sponsor are we looking at?
About £35,000.
Oh, God. But actually, it's not bad.
It's not bad, but essentially...
Jail term might be more fitting for locking someone up.
It's a bonkers story, but fortunately the referee was let out. And the Trabzonspor president won't be seen very often in public. And another few of the board members as well have got sanctions because of that.
And rightly so as well. Astana, champions of Kazakhstan. We've been talking about them a lot. They have won the league if you were worried about that for some unknown reason. And Chris, the European qualifiers, we're going to do a special podcast for the playoff round.
Yeah, four ties to get the last four places at France. They all look pretty even on paper. Norway against Hungary. Bosnia and Herzegovina against the Republic of Ireland, of course. Ukraine against Slovenia. And maybe the biggest tie is the Scandinavian derby. Sweden against Denmark. Zlatan Ibrahimovic, of course, he'd be a big miss if he wasn't in France. But Denmark are a good side. They'll be two really good games.
And we will put out a podcast once the playoff round's concluded to review what happened and to have a look ahead to the European Championships and El Clasico, which is coming up very soon. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please tweet us using @FIE Podcast. and subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes and keep us in the charts.
This is Football in Europe.